population. And in the course of the meeting, I actually narrowed this down, and we'll now talk a little bit more about the observations, because in the wake of the discussion that we had on the first day, I felt it might be worth pointing out the ways that might actually be available in order to constrain the issue of reprocessing a bit more from the empirical side in the high energy domain. So this is work that I'm doing in Heidelberg together with Gabriela Colonia and Mahmoud Mohammed, who are PhD students in our group, and Michal Zaharias, who is a postdoc. And I would like to go back first to the, something interesting happening here in the conversion. I apologize, I just had to convert from OpenOffice to Microsoft a few seconds ago. So I hope that this doesn't affect too many of the slides, what we see up here. So the story about this starts with 1ESO229+200, which was amongst the first few sources that has been explored very early on by the ground-based experiments, in particular by the HESS facility, in order to understand and constrain the extragalactic background light. The interesting aspect was that the source, despite the fact that by the time it was considered to be at relatively large distances, it could be traced out to very high energies of the order of 5, 6, 7, 8 TeV, which of course meant that we were in a domain where the opacities were already in the order of unity in excess of that. And that, of course, was not only interesting in constraining the extragalactic background light over a wider range in energies, but it was also pointing towards the issue that we might actually have to worry more about the intrinsic properties of the spectra to begin with, because the deabsorbed spectra implied extremely hard intrinsic spectra of the source, which were at odds with what at the time was considered to be plausible models for particle acceleration and reprocessing and radiative processes. So that generated a mini industry about 10 years back with people like Tavecchio, Lefa, Harunia, and Dermer, and many others, under trying to understand how you would actually have to modify the conventional picture in order to generate particle spectra that actually were sufficiently hard to explain what would be necessary in order to come up with the deobserved spectra that we actually observed. Now, beyond that particular aspect, of course, the hard spectra permitted the studies of extragalactic background light and the searches for reprocessed mitigation. It actually was one of the first sources where people really then wondered about probing the intergalactic magnetic fields. And all the various channels that, in principle, have been proposed were exploited, the spectral channel, morphological studies, temporal studies. And that then ultimately led to the discussion of whether there would be any other lost channels. And ultimately, I guess it led to this meeting. Okay, now this sort of becomes difficult. Let me see whether I might be able to do better with the PDF. Sorry. Can we just go back and... see whether I have a better way of... coming up with the full screen mode. Okay, that might be a bit better to see. So the first aspect was the morphological channel, which actually had been proposed more than 20 years back when Kopi, Aharonian, and collaborators actually suggested that pair halos might be detectable in case there is a non-vanishing intergalactic magnetic field, and therefore the reprocessed radiation might actually be dispersed over a wider angle. And that actually was one of the initial goals already in our studies with HESS, at least, to see whether or not we can find these pair halos. The latest word on that actually has been published about 2 years back, where there was no evidence found for pair halos in those studies, which at the time were considered to be the best examples for that particular study. And there are two different panels here which look as if they were similar, but they show slightly different things. The panel to the left here is PARCS 2155-304, which is the source that actually has the highest quote-unquote quiescent flux and therefore actually offers the best signal to noise. And in this particular case, you actually see all the data that are there. You see that the data are very well reproduced by the HESS point spread function. The maximum degree of halo emission that you might expect is actually shown by the green curve down there, and it's actually way beyond what could be addressed given the statistical signal, despite the fact that we have a very high signal to noise in this particular study. So the bottom line of this particular study was that there is no evidence for per halo to be detected within the statistical limitations. Now, in the case of O229, which actually is something like 20% further out, so the degree of distance is not all that large, the source is a lot fainter in the quiescent phase. There's more than a factor of 100 in the total flux. Now, in this particular panel, actually, the signal in the central peaks have been removed, and you're just looking at the residual in order to point out that there we are actually approaching a different problem. Interestingly, you see that in this particular case, the signal is way in excess of what the ideal point spread function for this particular object would be. It actually is close to the level that you might expect for a maximum halo, but in this particular case, it's the systematics that limits the particular detection. So in this case, again, the Hess collaboration doesn't claim a statistically significant detection of the halo, but the limits there are no longer on the photon statistics, the limits there are on the systematics. So the bottom line of these morphological studies, and I won't want to go any further into that for the remainder of this talk, is that there is no detection to date of a perhalo in the two best cases that there are, at least on the Hess side of the sample. But it actually there is significant room for improvement once we actually beat the systematics in understanding the point spread function, and that ultimately would indeed allow us to study the perhalos or the reprocessed light on a morphological basis. And this, in principle, is well within the capabilities of the existing facilities. The extent to which that actually will be done with the existing facilities or whether that's something which we'll actually have to await CTA remains to be seen. But there's definitely room for improvement from the current situation as we have it. Now let's move on and consider the spectral evidence for this particular case. And I go again, take a step back and look at the historical broadband data. For this particular object, there was a detailed study on the low energy part of the SED, quote unquote, and the main aim at the time had been to really understand whether the synchrotron branch allows you to come up with a better prediction for what the TEV emission might be, in particular in view of the fact that we actually had this hints towards a very high, very hard intrinsic spectra, which was at odds with the proposals for the radiation processes at the time. So this is coming from a detailed study by Kaufmann et al. A couple of years back, where there has been a very deep investigation, a very deep observation with the XMM during a particularly faint state of this particular source. Now this tries to sort of capture two main messages here. The first one is that it is an object where we have very little evidence for variability. This is the optical spectrum. This is the optical monitoring over a period of 6 years during which the Hess observing program was conducted. You see that there is no evidence for optical variability of that source over a period of 6 years. This is a combination or comparison of two X-ray observations, and they are coming from a period which is only 2 months extending in time over here, but it's covering the full dynamic range of what the source has ever shown historically in the X-ray band. So this is the lowest ever X-ray state that has been observed of this particular X-ray object, including the very early detections from the Einstein satellite in the 1970s. And just following that, there was a rise, which has been monitored by the SWIFT satellite, going up to the highest ever X-ray state that has been observed by this particular source. Now, this is a low dynamic range. It's only a factor of 2. It is not a dramatic variability by VLAX standards. It's a factor of 2, a doubling time about 30 days. And it's the most extreme variability there is. So the important point to note is, yes, there is variability, but it's by no means very amazing. There is little evidence in the optical band, very little dynamic range in the X-ray band. And as you see, the timescales are not extraordinary, which also meant that there aren't terribly tight constraints on the size of the source, which of course meant that there weren't very extreme constraints on the models that you had for the emission processes. Now, what was interesting at the same time was the fact that the galaxy-corrected optical spectrum actually turned out to be relatively hard. And in combination with the fact that we have a source which has a relatively hard X-ray spectrum that had actually been observed out to energies of the order of 70, 80 kiloelectron volts, so very high up for a synchrotron spectrum, people came up with a model which actually was rather extreme. Again, it was promoted by the desire to explore whether the classical models for the synchrotron emission were capable of coming up with very hard spectra. So it's not the best fit model as such. It's the idea to see whether a single, simple, one-component model along the classical guidelines were able to reproduce the very hard spectral indices that were required in order to explain the deabsorbed TV spectra. And it's indeed possible to do that, but it comes at a cost, because it would require you to have a very high energy gamma min in this particular model. The gamma min was of the order of 4 times 10 to the 5, which is extreme. There are very few ideas about how you could actually accelerate particles in a situation where this is your gamma min and you get rid of all the lower energy electrons. But if you were to accept that as a fact, then of course it's straightforward to come up with the hard TV spectra that there are. If you actually want to fit the optical data with a softer spectrum that's possible, note that the upper, the higher frequency values here are upper limits, so you actually can fit something which is a bit softer. Then, of course, you're ending up with far less extreme requirements on the minimum Lorentz factor of your particle distribution function, but then you have to tweak your models in order to explain the very hard spectra that we're observing in, or that we're inferring from the deabsorbed from the deabsorbed TeV emission. Now, following up on these initial studies, what's interesting is that the longer-lasting observations with the SWIFT-BUT facility experiment, going from 60 to 100 or more than 100 months by now, actually pushed the higher energies in the synchrotron branch out to beyond 200 kiloelectron volts. Of course, there's low statistics there, but there is clearly no evidence for a cutoff at the highest energies in the synchrotron branch at all. The very hard spectra out to 80, 70, 80-ish kilovolts have been confirmed by new star observations. There is very little evidence for variability in this band. Again, of course, the limited statistics by SWIFT, but doesn't allow you to sort of detect variations of the order of a factor of 2 on a 30-day timescale, as has been seen at the lower energy X-ray bands. But within what we actually know, there is no evidence for variability beyond a factor of 3 or 4. Which also, of course, says that this is a relatively good long-time average and a good predictor for what the long-time average spectral energy distribution in the synchrotron branch would be. This is maybe not so important at first sight for the problem of the reprocessing, but it's interesting in the sense that we are looking at sources which basically are stationary versions of what has previously been considered to be a really extreme example of a flaring object. Some of you may remember that the whole aspect of very hard flares had been started by an event in the 1990s when Makari and 501 showed an extraordinary flare. So that's coming from one of our old publications at the time. We actually had an MEV monitor, an MEV instrument award, the Compton Observatory, the oscillator instrument that actually sort of pushed the upper limits almost up to 1 MeV, clearly indicating that you can have very hard synchrotron components in blazars indeed, but that has been a sort of once-in-a-lifetime event for 501, and it's never been recorded for any other object. But you may consider O229 to be a stationary analog of that, which is also telling you we are not talking about the sort of average BLRC object here. It's something which really is very peculiar within the BLRC family. Okay, now moving on, discussing variability. There's been a compilation that was shown at the ICRC conference last year that combined the long-term observations by the Hess Observatory and by the Veritas facility that had been published earlier on by the Veritas collaboration. And this is really compiling all the variability over a period of 10 years by both facilities, rescaled to a common energy range. And you see that, again, there is variability. There's significant variability. So the probability of this being explained by constant emission is vanishing. But again, the amplitude is not dramatic. We are talking about a factor of 5 amplitude in the course of the events. And you see, but you see the variability both in the binning, which is shown in the upper panel, which is monthly bins, as well as in the panel which is shown below, which is annual bins. And I show this comparison because I would like to highlight one particular point here. Maybe it's better to be made here. the comparison actually is quite satisfactory between the two experiments, despite the fact that you might think, well, this looks a little odd. But what actually happened here is that the source was observed quite intensively with the Hess experiment during this low X-ray phase that I showed you earlier on. Then it gave rise to this increasing TV flux, and then the Veritas experiment picked up later on and saw a declining flare. And so together, collectively, they actually showed that there is indeed indication for an event here. The two data sets are completely consistent. But what it also shows you is that if you're not using a monitoring instrument, you should be very careful when looking at annual light curves, because this is indeed the annual flux average of those Veritas observations, which of course are dominated by the very intense observations conducted at the high phase, whereas this is the same year's annual average conducted by the Hess experiment, which is very much biased by the large number of hours spent during low phase, right? So despite the fact that I claim that this is perfectly consistent between the two experiments, if you look at the annual light curve, well, you couldn't have more of a difference between these two values for this particular year. So that's something to be kept in mind when we later want to compare long-term average light curves in the VEG band to Fermi. This is not giving you a good idea about what's happening. This at best tells you, well, yes, indeed, there is variability of a certain significance. Okay, moving on. Okay, more conversion problems. I hope this is the only one. Nonetheless, the fact that we do see variability actually provides us with some constraints on the reverberation as well. The reprocessed gamma ray emission would be delayed with respect to the primary gamma ray emission in case there was a non-vanishing magnetic field, because of this non-vanishing magnetic field introducing an extra path length with respect to the direct line of sight. And this delay has been computed by a number of people, Chuck, Andrew Taylor, Arlen, and so on and so forth. You may approximate it by a simple equation. You can do a little bit more of a careful exercise in coming up with models. The main point I would like to make is that the kernel that you actually have in the reverberation depends not only on the redshift and the strength of the magnetic field, but it also depends on the width of the cone. It depends on the inclination of the cone, and so on and so forth. So it can be quite a bit more complicated. But for the sake of the argument, we simply assume that the smearing of this kernel is proportional to the delay time on average. So if we were to make the argument that 600 GeV emission, which is the limit that I showed you in the light curves just previously, was indeed secondary emission, then the 30-day variability timescale would imply a limit on the broadening, which is of the order of a tenth of a year. And hence, by comparison to those models or these equations, a magnetic field, which can't be larger than some few 10 times to the magnitude 16 Gauss. So in principle, you can actually determine constraints under certain conditions from the variability that we do observe. And the fact that we do observe variability indeed actually allows us to, in principle, conduct reverberation studies which are quite a bit more detailed and might ultimately, if you make this assumption, also allow you to construct models that you can't access otherwise. So again, the message here is that ultimately, I believe reprocessing might clarify the issue of reprocessing. And I can say straight away that as far as I'm concerned, I would actually guess that, again, under those assumptions, the reprocessing to be studied by reverberation might be the most promising path towards a direct confirmation of this model, if it was viable. Now let's go on to the new observations conducted in the gamma ray band. This is a residual map actually conducted from PAS 8 analyses with the Fermilight instrument from 2008 to 2015. So it's the full data set that we have at the moment. And what's shown in this particular map is essentially hinting towards an order of caution if you really want to go for detailed studies of objects such as this particular object. What's done here is that you basically follow the standard analysis scheme. You basically take all your data, you subtract all the sources that are on the 3FGL catalog. In particular, you subtract all the sources according to the actual temporal variability within a circle of about 5 degrees around the source. For all the other ones, people typically sort of simply take the 3FGL fluxes and sort of subtract it. And what you get is this pretty horrible map, which is not at all flat, which has lots and lots of residuals all over the place. And you can, with hindsight, you can actually sort of see that in a number of historical data. The original publication by Wolf et al., who sort of claimed first that the source was indeed actually found in the LAT data set, had a spectrum like this. There were early reports about variability in the Fermi band, which looked like that. And in particular, this image here prompted me to sort of reconsider the variability with some more detail, because I happened to had studied this particular object, which is a little more than 5 degrees away, and I knew that this source actually had a pronounced flare at the early days of Fermilab. I was very much worried that the signal that we might actually see be entirely due to this particular object. And indeed, it turns out that there are two sources which are very strongly variable, which had been unusually bright in the first couple of years with Fermi. And that is, of course, also the epoch when this particular spectrum was compiled. So in addition, when we did the more careful exercise and subtracted O229 from the Fermi data set, then we also uncovered another source, which is not in the 3FGL catalog, but it's a bona fide, very well-known source. It's a very massive, massive black hole. It's a very, I mean, looking at the spectral energy distribution, it's a prototypical gamma ray source. You're not at all surprised to find it in the Fermi data set. If anything, you were surprised that this was a fainter source than O229 to begin with. But of course, if you model this source and if you model the other two objects which are variable, then of course both your spectral data and the temporal variability change. And this is again the message here that you need to do that. If you look at the residual maps, you easily uncover those two objects, which is, again, as I said, had been particularly bright during the first couple of years, which basically makes the 3FGL fluxes larger than what they are truly in the whole data set, and therefore, of course, in the residuals they show as negative depressions. This source wasn't in the 3FGL catalog at all. It's a clearly detected signal by now. And of course, it needs to be considered if you really want to work out on the spectra. And so this is basically what's happening in all the data that I show from now on. And I think you need to be aware about any potential differences with respect to other publications, earlier publications. It's been only thanks to PASS 8 and the larger data set that you actually were able to uncover that. And it's only due to the longer data set that you're really able to identify the offset that's coming from these two sources. Now, if you take all this into consideration, you find a somewhat odd spectrum in the gamma ray domain. A power law is not at all a good fit to the data set that you have. You get acceptable fits for something which is normally a possible model that's provided by the tool, so you can actually fit a broken power law. And you'll see that, interestingly, you have a broken power law, which is a lot harder in the higher G end. You can nominally also fit a log parabola to that with negative beta value in this particular case. Doesn't really attach any particular physics to it. But this is basically what you have. And so an interesting question that immediately emerges is whether or not this recovering at lower energies might be a spectral signature for secondary emission. Now let's be a little bit more go about this with a bit more detail and compare that to the matches in the TV band. And this is again a somewhat complicated story, so I'll spend a few minutes explaining this particular diagram. What we started out with doing is a free fit of a broken power law to Fermi that finds this break energy. So that's not put in by hand; it's basically determined by the free fit. It's about 3 GeV. This is then a power law to the high energy part of that, which is this limit over here. This is the published TV spectra coming from a long-term average. This is the deabsorbed version from this long-term average corrected by a Franciscini EBL. Let's ignore the deabsorption by a higher flux EBL for a minute. But then consider the fact that during those years when these observations were conducted with HISS, that preceding already some of the Fermi data, the source was on average about 30% brighter in the TEV band than it had been during the period 2008 and 2015. So we know that, and I believe with all the caveats that I mentioned early on, the 30% is a good guess. And we also know that in the TEV band, there is not a lot of spectral variability. So this is coming from this detailed study by the Veritas collaboration. You see a detailed or a reasonably high signal-to-noise Veritas spectrum in the bright phase, in the faint phase. You see the comparison to the long-term average by HISS, and there is no indication whatsoever of spectral variability. So what I believe we can actually do is we can take the long-term average of HISS, we can scale it down by 30%, attributing to the overall averages in the total flux to make it match the period during which the HISS, the LUT data were taken. And then you basically see that the extrapolation of the power law in the LUT band is a perfect fit to this 30% reduced deabsorbed spectra in the TEV band. So this match is basically as good as it gets. The two lines show you the extrapolation, which is the slightly harder spectrum and the combined fit, which is the slightly lower spectrum. But again, taking into account that the 30% estimate for the flux difference here is no better than sort of, let's say, a factor of two or three, then I believe this is perfectly consistent with being the same kind of line that we have over here. So taking all of this together, there's no evidence for a break above 3 GeV. Everything all the way into the TeV domain would be fit by a single component. So if you actually would want to consider reprocessing, then you might have to attribute that to something that's happening at lower energies. Or is there any other question? So that's the question, does the high energy part rule out reprocessing altogether? So I'm now switching over and simply ask how strict are the limits that we actually have. And now you could again argue that maybe there is indeed a higher extragalactic background level, and the original publication by the Hess collaboration actually considered a scaled up version of what at the time was considered to be a Primark model of the EBL, which is no longer used in the trade. But of course, this actually then gave rise to a harder spectrum in the TeV band. If you again apply the 30% reduction, then you would assume that this might indeed be the TeV spectrum, and then you would arrive at a break which is of the order of 300 GeV here. But I believe that this potentially suggestion actually can be ruled out because the ensemble studies of the extragalactic background light by now make this Primark model really a very extreme version. The Franceschini version is a lot more probable, so I believe that this is no longer a credible explanation. Of course, the other possibility would be that you have indeed an intrinsically equally hard TeV spectrum, where the degree of reprocessing that you see in this part of the spectrum miraculously sort of basically makes a perfect power law fit all the way down to 3 GeV, which looks a bit like a conspiracy, but of course can't be ruled out ab initio, right? So this is certainly a possibility. If you are still capable or interested in coming up with an intrinsic spectrum, which is very hard, going all the way up to 10 TeV and beyond, that's important. If you cut before 10 TeV, it doesn't work. You have to go beyond 10 TeV intrinsically, then you can actually still explain this with reprocessing. Okay, next step, you go and take your LUT data and consider the variability again. Two messages, again, you need to consider 08, 0235 plus 164. It's an important, constraint in the analyses. The second one, of course, we are talking about small number statistics, so take these light curves with a grain of salt, but the error bars are basically what they are. Now, if you look at both the low energy and the high energy component, you see that both of them are statistically clearly variable. A fit of a constant is ruled out for either of these two data sets in these one-year averaged light curves. Now, these one-year averaged light curves are better than the VHE ones because they have continuously been monitored. The two energy bands show variability amplitude of about the same size. They show about modulation on similar timescales, but the low energy version is definitely not a delayed and broadened version of the high energy part, right? So whatever the kernel might be, this is not delayed and reprocessed from that. So this can be ruled out. And therefore, we can definitely conclude that the low energy component, the soft component, the Fermi band, is not reprocessed from the hard component over here. So that is a constraint that is inevitable. Well, because if the hard component, right, if that was the primary beam, if you were to delay and reprocess that, you wouldn't arrive with a light curve which is below detection over here. It would be something which looked like
delay longer than the observation.
Unless you delay it by much longer than the observation time, but if you do delay it by much longer than the observation time, then the kernel of the broadening would also be much longer than the variability, and you wouldn't get variability on these sort of timescales. Now, of course, I completely agree that, well, you might say, well, it's been constant over here, and we don't have much of a rise, right? That's what I accept, right? But you still have a relatively sharp decay time. If you were to delay it by longer than the observations, you would have to delay it by more than 10 years, and that would imply a broadening of more than 10 years. And if you had a broadening of more than 10 years over a time set of 6 years, you wouldn't detect significant variability. Right? I agree, sort of within the numbers, the photon statistics, we are challenging the statement, but this is basically the logic of the argument. If you go for long times, you have a broadening. Okay, now on the reprocessing, going back to the gamma ray spectrum, with this inner, increasing energy or the broken power law, with sort of the second component being harder than the first one, this is only indicative of reprocessing at first sight. If you really wanted to make a reprocessing, so now talking about the possibility that indeed we are sort of reprocessing the TV emission into the soft component, then the break energy is too low for the soft component to be secondary. So this option is also very unplausible. Both spectral components are variable, as is the VHE flux. And so this, well, this is basically the argument I just made a few minutes ago. So pairs created by EBL absorption must lose energy in other ways. And of course, the whole conference is about a particular option here, so I don't need to go into this. I simply want to point out one more point is for the rather massive host that we have in 0229, pair creation losses in the host galaxy due to starlight actually are not completely negligible. So if you follow an approach that I'd done a couple of years back with Lukas Stavarts, where we explored the whole thing for Centaurus A and looked into how much of reprocessing we actually have within the host, then we find that the absorption is of the order of 10% of the losses that we have on the EBL of the extragalactic background light in the intergalactic medium. Of course, the dense radiation field within the galaxy, of course, reduces lambda, so you would do the reprocessing also on a smaller scale and give rise to galaxy-sized pair halo. But again, this is contributing a minor contribution, and given the difficulties in sort of identifying the reprocessed light from the EBL in general, of course, this would be even more challenging. Now, of course, there's this other question which sort of folds back to the problem of whether or not we're explaining a very hard intrinsic spectra, that at first sight, this overall gamma ray spectra looks very odd. A spectrum like this cannot be explained by the sort of standard models that people have suggested for blazars. It's certainly not due to a single electron population where your energy losses sort of increase with energy and you sort of have a downward curvature. And there's been a whole suite of suggestions that have been discussed for this and other cases in the past. People were wondering whether such a spectrum might be due to reprocessing. That's the story we've had over the last couple of minutes. People had been wondering whether or not you might be imposing an absorption feature in the GEV band due to a very dense UV radiation field in the vicinity of where you generate the gamma rays. People had suggested that maybe it's not due to absorption, but there might be sort of second or higher order inverse Compton scattering where the different components are sufficiently parted apart that you actually can observe a minimum somewhere in your observing band. People had wondered whether, of course, inverse Compton scattering of different radiation fields would give rise to multiple components. We've had this discussion before. Of course, you can also worry about different electron populations, which again come in natural. If you think in terms of a blazar model, there are stratified jets. There's no reason to believe that the particle distribution functions are universal throughout the entire jets. Of course, there could also be contribution to the core, to the knots, to the jet, and so on and so forth. And of course, there's the whole story of hadronic contributions, where you might, in addition to the usual components of proton synchrotron, you have synchrotron from the generated muons, and so on and so forth. All in your leptonic hadronic model, there are multiple components that make all that, all of which have been predicted or sought for at certain paces, but actually are very hard to tackle down. So I don't want to go through all these models. I mean, this is the most obvious one. We simply say we have inverse Compton secondary, so we get a break like this. Don't need to spend any more time on that. For the other ones, I only want to make a couple of very brief comments. The absorption by the UV field that's been promoted in particular by Stern and Putanen and others, that actually is not applicable because we actually have no indication whatsoever of the very strong UV fields that would be required. We have very good optical spectroscopy. We have very good X-ray spectroscopy from the very deep XMM observations during a fade state. There is no indication whatsoever for such a radiation field. Second or higher order inverse Compton scattering, again, is not applicable to this particular source. As I pointed out, the synchrotron at the beginning is going up to very high energies indeed. So you're talking about very large Lorentz factors and you're in deep Kleinischina. And so any higher order inverse Compton scattering would be strongly suppressed. Of course, if you then go about inverse Compton scattering of other radiation fields, then you would require leptons of lower energy, which have not been in our original model, which of course requires, comes up with other complications when you would like to make the very hard TV spectrum fit. And you require, in general, another leptonic component, which goes back to this model that I had over here about stratified jets or core contribution. It's actually more realistic than a single model anyway to begin with. But it is clearly ambiguous because it's under constraint, and you can sort of fit almost anything if you are willing to accept arbitrary particle distribution functions to come up and cook up the total SED that we actually observe. And the same problem comes with the hadronic contributions, where we have really very poor constraints on how to identify the other components. Nonetheless, I would like to show this little combo of other models, because I would like to sort of remind you of the fact that this problem is not unique to O229. There's other detailed modeling, for instance, of Fermi and TV spectra here of AP Libre, where you see multiple components, clearly see multiple components in the spectra. They have actually been fitted by multiple models, so that for, in this particular case, that's been recent work by Michael Zacharias. There are issues like Centaurus A, where we again have clear indications of hardening, which is attributed to multiple components. There are clear indications of multiple components in 501. So this is a spectrum where you basically turn from a spectral energy distribution like this to a component like that, where again you have an inflection towards higher energies in the Lac band over here. And of course, there's this whole set of hadronic models that I referred to earlier on. And you simply see that there's a whole suite of components to be considered. Of course, depending which model you pick, the various components have arbitrary strength, but this is really the complication that we're facing. And of course, there is this other possibility, and that's the last point that I would like to make. If you look at the spectral energy distribution of this particular object altogether, you start wondering how high up in energy can you actually make the synchrotron component go. Right? I mean, it's sort of intriguing to extrapolate that. Now, this is really pushing things to the limit, and this is really where we would go to extreme blazars. Again, a word of caution, this is not a great lever arm. Right? It's statistically significant, highly significant, that this is different from this spectrum, but there's a wide gap. What's interesting, again, as I said, the variability over here really points to something being intrinsic at that particular point in time. And not just for the sake of the argument, I'll go back to this very old Kaufmann model and completely arbitrary blow that upper gamma max up. So I don't do anything else except leave the breakpoint in place, I leave the gamma min in place, I leave the breakpoint in place, I leave the break of 0.5, the cooling break in place, I only shift up gamma max. And what you simply see is it's only affecting the synchrotron spectrum. You're so deep in Kleine Schiene, you don't see anything in the TV spectrum at all. Right? But the important point is you make sure that you go all the way up to 10 TV. Right? So that's certainly possible to do.
What is elements?
You caught me on that one. I have to look up. I don't know. I mean, this is a toy model. So there's not, we're not claiming that this is fitted to the data. So I just wanted to point out that this is a possibility that we actually have.
And that's the ordinary cooling breaks, deepening by one.
It's the ordinary cooling break, so there's no fancy stuff in there. It's just the standard model, and I only extend gamma max. And it matches, right? But of course, the three parameters, the gamma max that you put. But of course, the interesting point is that this slope with the ordinary cooling break matches this slope, right? The main disclaimer here is this is neither unique nor our preferred model. This is just showing you this might be an interesting hint towards extreme blazars if we indeed interpret the break that we see at GV energies as such. So to sum up all this, O229 really sort of is an important element. I don't want to consider it sort of a Rosetta Stone in this business, but it's been an interesting source, and it's been an interesting puzzle, and I believe there's still more stories to come out of O229 when it comes to the reprocessing problem. It's by now well detected in the Fermilab band, but you need to be very careful when analyzing Fermilab data because it's got a rich environment to it. It's certainly affected by nearby very variable sources, and you need to account for that. The full data set also reveals new sources in its vicinity, which you also need to consider for the spectral studies. There is an upturn at 3 GeV in the GeV spectrum. But if you then look at the harder of the two components in the Fermilab spectra, there is no break to the deabsorbed VHE data. So there's no spectral indication for reprocessing. As I already pointed out, there is no morphological indication for reprocessing, and the variability in the gamma ray spectral data do not support the model that explains that either of the two components we are seeing in the family lat beta are due to reprocessed secondary emission. I should say out though, glanced over that, this model, which again is not unique nor preferred, but that actually has the problem that over here we need to come up with something else, right? So if you were to believe this model, then indeed there would be reprocessing because we would be in this game of having a very steep intrinsic spectrum. The origin of the 100 MeV component is unclear. Of course, one interesting possibility is that it might be an extreme blazar. So that would be a situation where in blazars we're having a similar situation to the flares that we're observing in the Crab Nebula, where we have an additional component which pokes out at synchrotron, with synchrotron energies going all the way up to almost a GeV, with the important difference that this is more of a continuous source rather than a flaring source. The broadband models do not require or rule out reprocessed GeV emission. So that's the bottom line at this stage. I can't sort of tell you any better, give you any better message. We don't have any evidence for it, but we can't rule it out at this stage either. Unfortunately, the blazar models are not good enough to really pinpoint or predict the precise TV intrinsic emission in order to sort of subtract that from the combined data set that we have. Thank you.
Any questions?
Is this toy model that you mentioned by Kaufman, this just assumes a steady spectrum with a break?
Yes.
No spectral evolution.
There's no spectral evolution, and the motivation for that was indeed, as I said, there is no variability observed in the optical band at all, and there is very marginal variation observed in the X-ray band. So as far as the synchrotron component is concerned, there is hardly any indication for variability.
But if you use your, if you adopt some magnetic field strength, you can work out what the timescales for particles to lose energy are. They're very short.
They are very short, but the important point is the source doesn't vary. So whatever generates the spectrum needs to be a quasi-stationary mechanism.
Right, but this is not an equilibrium model.
That is true. I mean, as, that's what I said.
Yes,
I mean,
describe it to some injection, some steady injection.
Yeah, it is.
What should that be?
As I said, it is ascribing to a steady injection, and this is not meant to be a physical model that's full taking all these considerations into account.
Very bad at radio frequencies, as you said, at TV, so that model cannot be correct. I mean, it needs additional.
Well, for the radio frequencies, I didn't go into this. That's true that we did very bad, but this is a source where, indeed, if you look at the radio maps, you're dominated by the extended jet. So this is not the usual argument, well, there's something extended there. You can actually measure the extended stuff. And what you saw in the spectral energy distribution is more than 90% of the total flux is in the extended jet. Right? So the real core in the source is extremely faint, quote unquote. This is why this is, was an Einstein source. This was one of the original Bialak objects which were claimed to be not observable at radio frequencies at all.
But the data were not contemporaneous, right? They were just Ashido data mixed up with.
These particular ones that you saw in the spectra are not contemporaneous, but we re-went and observed the source contemporaneous with recent Hess observation, and we find radio fluxes at 5 gigahertz, which are way beyond a microgen scale. And that is very, very little for a Bialak object.
So on the topic of variability in the spectra, as long as your distribution function is evolving through some linear process, which comes with the variation,